Today, we're going to talk about something that affects almost everyone at some point during life, especially as we get older. It's one of the most common afflictions we know of, and yet it's also one of the most mysterious. It could just be a blip on the radar of your health story, or it can linger on for years, sometimes changing the course of your life, what you can do, what you can't do, and what you can enjoy. It's been called an epidemic, and research suggests it's only getting worse, not better. Today, we're talking about back pain. It's one of the leading causes of disability worldwide, and at any given point, more than 1 in 3 people suffer from back pain. And estimates are as high as 80% that you will suffer from back pain at some point in your life. And the problem keeps getting worse. The number of people with some sort of back pain is only slated to increase over the next 30 years, driven by many factors, especially our aging population.
There are more people who are now in their late 70s, 80s, and even into 90s, and you're going to say if things fall apart or things wear out, they're going to be more likely to wear out.
Today, we're going to sit down with experts on the spine, like Dr. David Baranko, who, as a neurosurgeon, has treated plenty of people with back pain and learned a few things about its impact on society along the way.
It is an epidemic in the sense that those two things, and back is a big one, are two of the major sources of lack of productivity in a person's life.
And despite the problem getting worse, and despite it being such a drag on people's lives and society in general, there are still few good answers when it comes to back pain. There are still some basic questions that are unanswered about back pain in the midst of all the information we have out there. Why does it come up? What does it lead to? How do we best treat it?
Everybody's looking for an answer. If you do a Google search for whatever it is, back pain, neck pain, scoliosis, whatever it is, you can find loads and loads of products with promises that aren't evidence-based or scientifically tested. And we need to have a framework for these things that has science and evidence-based. Yeah.
That's Dr. Jay Turner, another spine surgeon at Barrow. He and others are going to help us answer the question we're asking about back pain today, which is, why do backs hurt? Since back pain is this huge societal problem, only expected to get worse, what have we actually learned about why so many people suffer from it? Before we get started, there's another question that we have to answer, and that is, who cares? There's enough epidemics to worry about, enough health issues to ponder. Why should we care about back pain, or the spine for that matter? Well, there are a few good reasons why we should care. The first is pretty simple. Being in pain sucks.
Nobody wants to be in pain. It kind of ruins your mood and you're irritable and life sucks, right?
That's Kumar Kakarla, another spine surgeon at Barrow. He's treated his fair share of people with back pain that has developed into something far more serious. And when we say something more serious, we don't always mean physically serious. Back pain is linked to a variety of psychological problems as well. Some studies show that people with back pain are up to 2 times more likely to develop depression. Back pain, like other pain in your body, can prevent you from doing the things you love, from staying active, even from getting a good night's sleep. There's also evidence that being in constant pain can actually rewire our neural circuits and our brains in many ways. And all those things can contribute to this interplay, this question of whether back pain can actually affect the mind itself.
It's a very good question, but a very complex question, because as you're saying, there are people where initially there isn't a psychological feature at all. If you have somebody who has, let's say, back pain, and they've been told several times that it's not surgical, and the conservative things are failing or not making it better, then you have to worry more about secondary depression and things like that, forming a so-called situational depression.
The second reason we should care about back pain is that, in addition to affecting the mind, it can also affect every other system in the body. The spine is similar to other joints in the body, but it's also very different. It's almost like it's the central joint in the body. It's impossible to move without using your spine in some way.
The spine's interesting. In many ways, it's a series of joints that age. You've got, you know, bones stacked up on top of each other that have a disc in the front and two joints in the back. And that's, you know, so you have these motion segments in your spine, but different from other joints in our body.
And what is a joint exactly? Well, the knee is a joint, just like the hip. A joint is any meeting point between two bones that allows those two bones to move in relation to another. And that's the thing. The hip is one joint, and the knee is one joint. But the spine has over 70 of these joints.
One, there's a whole series of them on top of one another. And two, it's surrounding critical structures, which are the nerves and spinal cord. The aging spine is often, you know, degeneration of those motion segments, just like you get in your knees and hips and shoulders. It's just the consequences are different in the spine because of the neural elements that are there and the nerves that are there.
So the spine is different than many other joints. It surrounds critical structures like nerves. And when things go wrong with the spine, even if it's been building for many years, it can lead to lasting damage to nerves or even the spinal cord itself.
Most concerning to us are when there's neurologic deficits, when there's some sort of problem that if we don't intervene, we risk them having permanent problems that they'll never be able to recover.
Now, not every spine problem develops into something serious. And you shouldn't go panicking that your back pain will devolve into affecting your nerves or your spinal cord. It's just to say that our spines are important, not least because they surround and protect critical structures. They're the central joints in our body, central to the way we move. And that when backs hurt, we should pay attention to why. So we've established that back pain is this major problem in society. It's also a huge problem for the people with it, and it doesn't just cause physical pain, but mental pain as well. And to top it off, there are few good answers for back pain, few guidelines for treatment, and few people to turn to for help when the problem arises. Do you turn to a surgeon, a primary care doctor, maybe a chiropractor, maybe the internet? We're going to keep digging deeper to get to the root of the problem, the why part. The why backs hurt question. And to do it, we need to understand some basic things about how the spine is built. And that's because the problems with the spine we're talking about can start with many different causes. But today, we're going to focus on degeneration of the spine, or breakdown of its different components. That's the most common reason for issues with the spine, more common than things like genetic syndromes, cancers, or trauma. And so we need to understand what a spine is. How it functions first in order to understand how and why it breaks down.
The spine is very unique in its shape and its form and function.
That's Dr. Brian Kelly, the director of the Barrow Biomechanics Laboratory.
My name is Brian Kelly. So in terms of core training, I'm a mechanical engineer, did an undergraduate and a master's in mechanical engineering. Then I went out and I worked in the field for a while, but I realized I really wanted to continue in research, especially biomechanics related research. So decided to go back to school as a more mature student and received a PhD in biomedical engineering.
Dr. Kelly and the biomechanics lab are focused on understanding how the spine is built and also how it functions under normal and abnormal circumstances.
We're interested in the forces and movements of human joints. And as our lab specializing in spine, in particular the spinal column, we also want to understand something about what happens with normal forces and movements in the face of degenerative change and or trauma, and in particular when surgical intervention is required.
Dr. Kelly has thought a lot about how the spine is structured and about all of its individual components.
Often they have unique profiles. They're very guided by ligamentous contributions and stabilization and also muscles. And so there's kind of a symphony there of effort. The spine, it has some similarities to the larger sort of articular joints. So in that we have in the posterior region, we have the facet joints, which are basically synovial type joints with cartilage, synovial fluid, they're encapsulated. And so they're kind of mini versions of some of our larger joints like the knee and hip. But then in the anterior part of the spine, the front part of your spinal column, you have this intervertebral disc, and there's nothing like that in the body. And if I could describe it briefly, I would say, I often joke that the intervertebral disc is like a jelly donut because I like donuts. And so if you try to visualize something that has a sort of a soft gelatinous core that is hydrostatic, it can withstand pressures, And it's encapsulated and surrounded by a series of annular walls. And so in a compression loading where you have one vertebral body, you have this intervertebral disc that's attaching to the next subadjacent vertebral body. So basically two rigid bodies with the disc sandwiched in between. So when that comes under compression, that soft gelatinous core wants to escape, but it can't because the annular walls contain it. And so the intervertebral disc becomes pressurized, and that helps for shock absorption and compliancy. And also those outer walls, they get sort of stressed usually through radial bulging, but they can also withstand some tension and compression. And so, you know, you're talking about something that's about 5 centimeters wide, 2 centimeters high, oval-shaped, interconnecting all of the bones of the spine. And so there's people that dedicate a lot of research just to understanding the intervertebral disc, how it functions and its biochemistry, how is it, you know, what's healthy and what precipitates degeneration. So yeah, the spine is very unique in its shape and its form and function.
Now, we know the spine isn't just built of bones or discs and joints. There's muscles and ligaments that attach to it. And those components add a lot to the stability and overall resilience of the spine to handle everyday movements, stresses, and loads.
I would say that musculature role is maybe twofold. One is providing stability. So your passive spinal column, so your bones and ligaments and discs that make up the column itself, it has a little bit of inherent stability. Meaning on its own, it doesn't want to move, but it's more the musculature that provides most of the stability. In fact, there's a kind of a reflex mechanism where some of the muscles that span the spine, if they're suddenly stretched, so maybe somebody throws me something, a small weight, and I catch it. And so there's like a sudden disturbance input. The muscles sense that they initially may stretch a little bit, but then there's this involuntary reaction where they tighten and stiffen and stabilize. And so that goal there is to provide stability, particularly if you were lifting a heavy object. You don't want any sudden or excessive movements of the joint. You want to correct for those. But to the other part, muscles definitely work in concert with the joint to have a normal loading profile. There was one study that linked poor multifidus muscle function with was associated with higher levels of degeneration in the facet joint. And it kind of puts me in the mind of a long time ago, I was interested in running and trying to run longer distances. And I talked to a physical therapist friend of mine who did, you know, the Ironman competitions. And I said, hey, what's the secret to not injuring your joints as you're doing this? And she just immediately said, strength training twice a week. Because the muscles play a role in the whole sort of motion of the joint. So if you imagine if I'm running or I'm repetitively doing things or I have poor muscle quality, the muscle's not doing its job anymore. It's not carrying the load and it's not dynamically distributing the load. So what takes up that abnormal loading or potentially excessive loading is the joint. When the muscles don't do their job, it transfers over to the joint, and that can do it in an unhealthy way that can lead to overstressing and then eventual damage and wear and tear.
It turns out that the spine, without all the muscles and ligaments that support it, can only handle a certain limit of force. And when that limit is exceeded, or when the supporting structures no longer shield the spine and its elements from force, that's when the spine starts functioning outside its normal capacity. And that's when degeneration can happen. So, what exactly is that limit for the spine? It turns out that question doesn't have a very simple answer.
That's a good question. There's a lot of variability, obviously. If I do give a talk on musculoskeletal biomechanics, one of the things I like to ask students is, what do you think the amount of force is going across your knee joint during just normal level walking? We get up and we walk out of here. How much force do you really think is the two bones contacting each other? How much are we talking about? And kind of have them guess. And it turns out that the number is in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 times your body weight. So what I think a lot of people don't realize is that because of the mechanical disadvantage that your joints have, there's actually a lot of force being generated through the joints. With the spinal column, you know, studies have shown that, or estimated that, if I'm bending forward and I'm using, say, poor lifting mechanics, so I'm not using my legs, I'm bending straight forward, and I'm trying to pick up, you know, a 10 kilogram weight, there can be in excess of a few thousand newtons, up to 2,500 newtons of load. So that's an amazing amount of loading for the spine to carry. So it is capable of carrying very excessive loads, maybe during normal daily activities less. We don't have as good a handle on the loads in the spine as we do on the knee, just because it's much more complex. There's many more muscle groups, and it's hard to distill down exactly what's happening there.
It turns out that that limit isn't exactly like a firm threshold. Returning to that symphony analogy that Dr. Kelly introduced, it's not like the orchestra all of a sudden starts playing irregularly at a certain point. It may be more like one instrument that is slightly off key, or a particular group of musicians that plays out of sync. And that dysfunction can build slowly over time, leading to other instruments getting off key or out of sync.
If we treat things holistically, so if we think of the actual passive joints themselves, the musculature, all the fascia, and how you're wired to move, all kind of working in concert. And if all that's working well, then everything's great. So the question is, does a clinical problem show up because something in that concert kind of broke down? There's a dysfunction in there. That's kind of one way to look at it. The other way is to look component by component. And so when and why does the intervertebral disc start to break down? It's a very sort of complex biochemical balance. You know, in the nucleus pulposus, you have all these molecules. You have type 2 collagen, proteoglycans, and cellular signaling, and so forth. And when all of that's in balance, everything works well. And when the intervertebral disc works well is when the center, that gel core I talked about, is well hydrated, and therefore under compression loads, it can create that pressure situation. The breakdown for the disc is a biochemical dysfunction. That can be age, cell-mediated factors, genetic factors, and then we know they can be accelerated by nutritional or mechanical factors come into play, like excessive or abnormal loading, obesity, all of that. Maybe you're lifting excessively heavy loads and so forth. So I think it starts with a biochemical dysfunction, at least in the intervertebral disc, and that could be affected by a lot of variables. But that dysfunction ultimately leads to structural changes in the disc, most notable being that the nucleus starts to become dehydrated. It doesn't attract water as well. And when that happens, that basic pressurization function of the disc also starts to break down. And so instead of those outer walls kind of bulging, now they're taking a load that's more kind of cranial caudal or straight up and down, which they weren't necessarily intended to do. And that can lead to, they can start to buckle, which they shouldn't because they've lost that internal pressure. They can start to suffer micro tears, maybe become vulnerable to herniation, that kind of thing. Once that starts to happen, even in a small amount, and I can speak more if you want to talk about how the motion starts to get affected. But once you start to lose that little bit of height on the disc, the whole dynamic of the joint starts to change and it becomes a cascading slope to where everything's starting to get loaded either abnormally or excessively, and then it leads to further degenerative change.
It turns out that this idea of irregular load and motion abnormality play a key part in the cascade of degeneration of the spine. Think of it in terms of the symphony. It's like plucking strings on an instrument too harshly, and that can lead to an instrument being out of key. And then that instrument being out of key can lead to other instruments playing off beat. Pretty soon, the entire orchestra is just a bit off.
So one of the questions biomechanists have asked and tried to test on the bench, and there's been clinical studies looking at this too, is with, say, very early stage degeneration, what happens to the motion of the spinal joint? There's actually quite a bit more there to unpack than you might think. So what I would do is I would break it down in terms of when we think of motion, we can think of range of motion, how much does something move? And we can think about quality of motion. So in terms of range of motion, there's been studies have done where we've tested sort of cadaver spines, and the intervertebral discs have been scanned and graded for degeneration. And what they found in the thoracic spine, for example, was even just a mild amount of degeneration started to limit the range of motion. When I say range of motion, I mean rotation of the joint, rotation of one vertebral body with respect to the other. Similar studies in the lumbar spine have had mixed results. With early degeneration, the range of motion has been reported to reduce. but in some directions it's actually been reported to increase. So it's a little bit of a mix there. But the other factor I want to add into that is something called the neutral zone. And so when we break down the motion, spine biomechanists have learned to classify that in the early range of the motion, say I'm rotating a spinal joint, the initial rotation takes very little resistance. And that makes sense because I have ligaments that are spanning across the joint that are kind of like elastic bands that are going across the joint to stabilize. And in the early motion, they're not being stretched and recruited. But as I keep rotating, those engage more and more and they become stiffer and stiffer. So if I was to make a profile plot of how much load I'm inputting to how much I move, I see a lot of early motion, or, well, not necessarily a lot, but I see some easy early motion. And then after that, the motion gets harder and harder. And so where I'm going with that is, at least one study has suggested or shown that with degeneration, that early zone, what we call the neutral zone, where we get a motion with very little load, it actually increases. So it's almost as if the play, if you think of play in a mechanical system, the play in the joint is increasing. And the other thing is, I haven't talked about translational motion. So if you think about my intervertebral disc height shortening a little bit, the ligaments that span across the joint become lax, right? They don't take up force as early as they did. And so you have this, again, idea that the joint has some play. It can kind of move, maybe translate a little bit back and forth, maybe rotate a little bit more than it did under normal circumstances. And now here's where the normal loading mechanics have started to change. So the facet joints, for example, might take up some extra work trying to stabilize that translation. And so you end up again with abnormal or excessive loads on different parts of the joint, not how it was designed. And so generally speaking with motion, I think there's that early play. Early degeneration, depending on the spinal area, can usually decrease, but sometimes increase the motion. But then as you progress more to more and more degeneration, it's clear the motion decreases down to a minimal amount. And one other comment I'll make is that if we talk about loading through the spinal column, the intervertebral disc, the anterior part of the column, that takes usually about 80% of the spinal column load, and the posterior part with the facet joints usually about 20. That's in a healthy spine. But as we get more degenerative, that shifts more towards 60 in the anterior and 40 in the posterior. So again, with that disc collapse, load sharing shifts more posteriorly, and again, we get, abnormal loading.
This excessive load and abnormal motion start a cycle. As the joints start to move irregularly, it leads to more wear and tear on the system, which leads to more irregular motion, and so on. So far, we've answered the how and why of the spine breaking down, how the spine starts to degenerate as a result of abnormal loading or excessive forces, and what those processes do to the individual components of the spine. But there's a larger why that needs to be answered. Why does the spine break down? Well, because of a cycle of abnormal load and forces that cause certain changes. But why? Put another way, who does this happen to? Why do some people have the process set in play and others don't? It turns out that the leading theory is simply that this is a process of aging. And while there may be certain genetic conditions that predispose people to wear and tear on their joints, like rheumatoid arthritis, and certain things we do to our bodies, like beat them up in sports, that make our joints more susceptible to damage down the line, there's no single thing other than the broad forces of aging that sets this process in motion.
There are specific autoimmune genetically derived conditions, rheumatoid arthritis, lupoid arthritis, where you know that there's an inflammatory reaction that affects the joints, for example, in rheumatoid arthritis, and they get destructive changes. They have pain, they have discomfort, they have joint replacements and all these kinds of things. We also know that there are people who are physically putting too much demand on their joints, right? We see this in football, where the new offensive linemen and defensive linemen who weigh 320 pounds have much more force on a knee or a joint or a ligament when they cut and twist and whatever. And you see more injuries now than you did 30 years ago when people weighed 50 pounds less or 60 pounds less, and right, they performed professionally in the same sport in that same position.
But those sorts of things aside, What about the average person? Why do we start to feel that nagging pain in our lower backs or our necks at a certain point in our lives? The answer is that we get old, and getting old has consequences for the spine.
No structure is made to last forever. You buy a car, sounds absolutely silent. It's a beautiful thing. But when that car has 80,000 miles on it, it's got little pings, it's got little rattles, it's got little shakes. It's the same thing with your back, your hip, your knee. You may notice that when you play tennis, you can't look back as far with your neck because it just doesn't go as far. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong. Mm-hmm. It may mean that it's different, that at age, 71, when you're playing tennis, you can't look up as far in extension to hit an overhead as you could when you were 30, right? Now, if your neck starts bothering you, then it can be that there's something mechanically that is degenerative or arthritic, or the wear and tear changes can't do that extra thing that allows you to play tennis, and it's sore or it hurts afterwards, right? You don't see a lot of people who are age 38 having a total knee replacement for, right, degenerative process. You do see a lot of people who are 70 having a knee replacement, and it's the same concept.
Aging means that our bodies can't repair damage as quickly as they could when we were younger. That same damage, those same forces might still be applied to the spine. It's just that now our bodies can't deal with it as well. Here's Dr. Kelly again.
I think aging is definitely, yeah. I mean, even if you did everything else perfectly, you had great nutrition, you exercised, aging's going to catch up with all of us. So at some point, something in the programming doesn't regenerate as fast as it degenerates. It doesn't repair everything that needs to get repaired. And then you start to lose function that way.
One main way that aging affects the human spine is through the intervertebral disc. There's well-established evidence that as we age, our discs lose some of their water content. And losing that water content makes them less able to absorb shocks.
When the intervertebral disc works well is when the center, that gel core I talked about, is well hydrated, and therefore under compression loads, it can create that pressure situation. The breakdown for the disc is a biochemical dysfunction that can be age, cell-mediated factors, genetic factors.
Or to put it another way,
if I had a car and it had air shocks, for example, and I let out half the air, I hit a pothole, it's different than when that shock is full of air.
Okay, there's one more question we have to answer about back pain. We've covered the why it's important, the how it's built, and the how and why it happens parts. But there's one final part that's missing, and that is, where does the pain come from? So far, we've assumed that as parts wear and tear, that causes pain. But why is that? And to answer this question, we're going to turn to one more person, Dr. Zaman Mirzadeh, who is an expert on pain.
What is the connection between abnormal motion and pain? You can move your joints and they don't hurt, right? Like you move your finger, it doesn't hurt. I think what makes it abnormal is that it's inflamed. It just degenerates, right? The two end plates come within close apposition of each other. The same thing happens with the facets, right? So like you lose the synovium becomes brittle and chalky and loses water content as it degenerates. And we talk about like bone on bone. The end plates are very close to each other. There's some stress, like excess stress that's imparted on the end plates or on the ends of the facet joints, the respective facets that are forming the joint, they're feeling too much strain. They shouldn't feel that strain. Normally they don't because there's a healthy synovium between them. And so it doesn't transmit to the bone.
As the disc starts to degenerate, there's less cushion between the bones and the spine. And that leads to more and more pressure on the bones above and below the discs, and also more pressure on the joints in the back, the facets. That's the process of wear and tear that we discussed earlier.
And this hypothesis of like the bone cells that are in the adjacent end plates that are close to each other. And chances are they release some factor that's pro-inflammatory. Then you get a recruitment of inflammatory cells. These degenerated discs and joints are full of like inflammatory cells, right? And I think that's where the pain comes from.
The excessive wear and tear results in inflammation around the bones and the joints. And it turns out that that inflammation is sensed by nerve endings in the same neighborhood.
And the inflammatory cells are secreting factors that are picked up by the nerves that make them sensitive. And so then the nerves are firing because they're receiving these pro-inflammatory signals, which is kind of the same way we think about pain when you get a cut. There's inflammation and then there's pain. Now, the initial cut, there's pain because there's pain sensed from like the acid that's released by the tissue after a cut, and that there's like this immediate pain. But then there's this like hypersensitization response that's adaptive that helps you protect that area. So you have a cut and the area around the cut hurts for a while. It's extra sensitive. So if you even touch that area, it's kind of painful, even though it's not like you're cutting yourself again. You're just touching an area that's been sensitized by the fact that it's inflamed. That's well known in the pain world that like, you know, there's this like inflammatory milieu that kind of sensitizes the pain, the nociceptors, the pain nerves in that area get sensitized. So now non-noxious stuff produces a noxious response. If you get an area that's inflamed, a normally non-noxious thing, such as movement, may cause pain, right? Maybe yeah. picked up as pain, the yeah. same way as like deflection of your skin around a cut will be yeah. painful. I think of degenerative disc disease as an inflammatory pain. That's why we call it like arthritis.
Despite being one of the most common afflictions that doctors see and that patients suffer from, back pain still retains a bit of a mystery. Perhaps it's because the spine is so complex, so integral to our lives. There's so many other reasons why backs hurt. Hopefully, we've uncovered some of the most common, digging down into the why of the most common cause, which is simple or not so simple degeneration as we age. There's a whole host of other changes that occur to the spine as we age, as a result of degeneration, and we didn't cover those. Things like stenosis, or narrowing of the spinal canal, and herniated discs, which can impinge on nerves and cause pain far away from the spine, in the arms, or the legs. It's important to note that back pain and degeneration of the spine are huge, broad topics, and we've just scratched the surface here. And hopefully, if we've done it right, this huge problem, this phenomenon that most of us will face at some point in our lives, makes just a bit more sense now, even if we have other questions. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Barrow on the Brain, and we hope you'll take a moment to leave a review or subscribe to our new podcast. Reach out to us at info@barrowneuro.org. We'd love to hear from you, hear what you think, and hear about any topics you'd love to hear more about. When emailing us, please refrain from sending personal health information. And for all things Barrow 24/7, follow us at Barrow Neuro on your favorite social media platforms.